Welcome to season two of Beyond Beauty. I'm so excited. Where I talk with visionary artists who share their journeys, influences, and creative processes. My name is Jacqueline Cofield, and I research and study artistic praxis. This season brings together a wonderful and diverse lineup of voices, artists whose roots and cultural backgrounds shape the art they bring to the world. Each conversation reveals not just the artwork, but the personal and collective narratives that inspire it. Join me as we explore the intricate blend of heritage, creativity, and purpose that defines these remarkable women artists. Today, I'm excited to bring you a conversation with the extraordinary artist, Renluka Maharaj. Her work bridges memory, identity, and ritual, drawing from her journey between Trinidad and Tobago and Colorado, her embrace of Hindu traditions, and her deep connection to nature. We explore her early experiences crafting with Trinidadian clay, her relationship with land in the natural world, and how these elements shape her creative practice. Join me as Renluka discusses the intricate layers of family, heritage, and place woven throughout her art, inspiring a sense of reflection and connection. Let's get started. Renluka Maharaj, what an honor and a joy to have you with me today, to be in community with you, and to talk about so much. I'm so excited about this interview. I've been researching your practice, and your work actually came to my awareness from a friend of mine who is using your work in her course that she's teaching. And she even told me that she's been writing about your work. So she was super excited and told me, you have to contact Renluka. So I'm so grateful. This podcast has been such a learning journey for me. So I'm hoping that everyone who's able to listen to it is also learning alongside you and I as we go through these discussions, these creating these oral histories. So thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you, Jacqueline. It's great to be here with you. I think I know the person you're talking about. She actually addressed my work at Columbia this year, right?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. She's okay. Yeah. And she's also teaching at Queen's College, I believe it is. Yeah.
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 The way I have been taught.
Yeah. She's
so wonderful.
Yeah. She's so excited about today. So I am here recording at Teachers College, Columbia University. So I'm grounded in this thinking about learning experiences, and particularly around the arts. So I like to start with a question about your early creative expression or exposure or thinking about creativity. So reflecting on your childhood, were there any formative experiences that sparked your interest in creative expression? How did you come to see art as a form of communication and exploration?
As far as being a kid, you know, I used to make things from clay a lot. The thing about Trinidad is the dirt that you walk on, just the regular dirt. It's just the most beautiful clay. And so I used to spend a lot of time in the back of the house making things out of clay. And another thing that I remember, it's a good question because I was thinking about this the other day. I remember when I was so much into color as a child and always wanting to color things. And I remember my classmates taking my drawing or my coloring because they liked it so much. And I never really thought about oh, this could be something. I didn't know anything about art as a kid. Like, you're a little Indian kid. You're supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer or something. And you're not supposed to be an artist. But when I do think of it, yeah, there were some things that I did as a kid. And I can say that art has always been part of my life. And I've always fascinated because I grew up very Hindu. You know, my mom is very devout. And so I loved watching the rituals, experiencing the rituals, the colors, the smells, the textures of things that were around me all the time. I didn't know that I was taking in this information and retaining this information. But now in my work, I can see that influence all the time.
Mm.
Yeah.
When you're making this clay as a child, did you have some art classes in school? How did you know to do that?
No, you just like do stuff, you know? It's like, I mean, I grew up on a farm. I grew up with a lot of animals around me. I had a pet monkey, I had a goat, I had, you know, those are kinds of friends you grew up
Wow.
with. And I would spend time with them, you know, in the pasture. And it was just something to do to kind of like pass the time. You know, besides climbing trees and killing things that, you know, like snakes and stuff, or hunting things down. You know, it was like part of the thing I did. It was, oh, we're gonna go make a little piece of furniture. And they were really tiny, you know, they weren't anything significant, but my hands just wanted to do that. And so I just let that happen. And I'm so glad you asked that question, because it really, what I try to do now almost every day is to tap into those memories of when I was a child, of how I grew up, where I grew up. What were those feelings? What were these things that were special to me? Not only to inform my art, but also to remember my ancestors, to remember my home country, and to remember, you know, all of that is everything that made me me thus far.
Yeah. Actually, you're touching on something that I have in a later question that I think I might ask it now. I see that your work draws so heavily on your family's history as indentured laborers in Trinidad and Tobago, particularly the narratives of women from India and the Caribbean. How do these oral histories, memories, and cultural practices within your family shape your understanding of lineage and identity?
Well, I think, you know, identity is a tricky thing, right? Especially, I feel, when you've been displaced so many times. And I think holding on to the memories, to the whatever memories I can attract, whatever memories I could gain, that helps me and brings me closer to, say, my grandparents are the one who came over, right? They were on the boat, they were on the ship that came over. And I didn't really know them very well. I didn't know them long. I never met my grandmother. And so keeping the visuals alive, because there are very, very few photographs of my family. I have one picture of my Nani and Nana, which is my maternal grandparents. And so any sort of like tangible thing I can have, I keep it with me to remind me of that. So the last couple of weeks in the Hindu calendar is when our ancestors come down and visit with us, right? And so you pray to them every day, and then you feed them, you honor them, you speak their names. And today was the last day for that. So I put out all the, you know, these rice balls and stuff like that. It's all traditional. And all of these things bring me closer. All of these things make me feel like I can communicate with them, because it was almost sad to say goodbye today again, right? Because we've all passed on, and saying goodbye again today was actually kind of difficult for me. And I realized that while I was praying. But yeah, I think keeping the information alive, keeping as much of items alive, you know, this sort of these artifacts of our existence really helps me to connect, which helps me to connect to the work.
This idea of proximity mediated through tangible artifacts, through tangible items, it's really intriguing because when I'm doing a deep dive into your practice, these ideas around spatiality come up and this sensorial engagement that you're creating in different spaces, because I see that you're doing work that's meant to be outside, that's made outside, like your garden project that you did in 2021. Can you share more about how the natural environment shaped this piece and how working outdoors influenced your creative process?
So I'm actually working more and more outdoors now. And, you know, this has a lot to do with thinking about my ancestors and how they originally lived before being displaced, right? Before being taken, and their connection to the land, and how much of what we practice as far as our spirituality is connected to the land. And so I wanted them to exist within a space I felt would be most comfortable for them, where they could be celebrated, where they can be revered within these natural spaces. Because I feel like when we get disconnected from the land, we get disconnected from our truths, from our real connections, from the things that make us strong, but from the things that make us a community. You know, before we were ripped apart and sent on some plantation. And because, you know, under those circumstances, we're never really us, right? We're under these strenuous circumstances that has really taken away all of who we are. So we can, and we need to do that in order to survive. We need to put on this mask in order to survive and to be the person that can get through the day. And so I want to unmask them in a sense, and I am unmasking along with them through this entire process, you know, where I am now interjecting myself into the work. Mm. So I am taking pictures of myself that are out in nature right now, so I can sit in that space with them as well, and to be even closer and to feel even closer to their energy, to their messages, all of that. So yeah, where I create the work is really important to me right now. I'm very much engaged on the outside because I have made it a point to always pray outside, to touch the earth, to touch the trees, to touch the grass, because it's a very grounding and spiritual thing for me to do. And I feel by doing that, I'm just closer to them.
It's interesting, this idea of being closer to them as you become closer and engage more with the land. I'm thinking about the fact that you've lived in so many different places. You've lived and worked in various communities and environments in New York, in Colorado, Trinidad, Tobago, and you've traveled extensively. So can you talk about what different types of learning experiences these different environments are giving you? What different types of influences are these different landscapes, geographies, how are they these influencing your work?
I used to travel a lot more than I do now because I felt like I was always in search of something. I'm always trying to find something, like understand something, solve something, you know, this whole idea of finding out my family history and finding out the women, the images that I work with, and to think about them all the time is to solve a problem, right? Mm-hmm. It's like going into different spaces. That's me, like, it grounds me in different ways. So when I'm in Trinidad, I'm home. Mm. I'm just home. I get off the plane. You can smell it. There's a sense of, like, as soon as you get there, it's like you exhale. And it's just like, oh, my God, everything is familiar. Everything sounds familiar. I can understand and feel and express myself the way I want to and not feel like I need to pretend.
Mm.
Here in Colorado, it's where I live now. It took me a really long time to adjust because none of my people are around me. I mean, one friend actually moved recently, which is nice, but I hardly see him. It's forcing me to kind of accept land in a different way and home in a different way.
Mm.
You know, New York was also home because I was brought up in New York ever since I was a kid. So I had a close connection to Brooklyn. And now that I have no family members that live there anymore because everyone has moved out. So I have nobody in Brooklyn. I have family in like Long Island, but not in Brooklyn. So this year was a year of loss, a lot of loss for me. And I started thinking more and more about that, about, okay, now I don't have this relationship to Brooklyn in this way anymore because I'm not going to go there and see them.
Mm.
I'm not in a good zone. You know, I'm kind of like here in Colorado, even though this is not where I see my life to be the happiest, in as much as the connection to things, the people, the food, the culture, I have nothing in common with a lot of people here. So I spend a lot of time, you know, in my studio. But I've come to realize I can form relationships with nature, and that becomes like this common denominator within these spaces, right? So if I have a tree here that I hug every day, and I'm doing that because I want to see how it changes. I want to see how, like, what is that relationship going to be like? So I'm forming different kinds of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I'm forming and becoming more interested in, like, home is not necessarily a place,
that, you know, people in my life can exist in multiple places. Mm. And to find a way to include that in the work as well, where, you know, because like my ancestors being removed from India, they never went back. They had to come to terms with first being on a ship and then being in a whole new country. And they had no idea where they were and how they needed to adapt. Right. So now I have this understanding of, right, okay, I have adapted, and then now I've chosen to adapt the way I need to adapt and not have. And that's something I have to feel forced to do so I can belong in a particular space.
Mm.
And I'm doing that with nature and my spiritual practice.
Wow. You got me thinking about when you were speaking, imagining home as not so much a place, but as like a way.
Yes.
And I just thinking about how your own experience is not exactly mirroring, but is a mirror to your ancestors' experience with you doing all this travel and sort of having to constantly renegotiate this idea of home, of these ideas of belonging. You get a little mm-hmm. taste of what they've experienced. Mm-hmm. You mentioned your studio practice, and I always love to, a lot of times when I'm engaging with artwork, a lot of times I like to imagine what the artists look like in their studio. I'm like,
oh, this is my studio.
I'm like, are you neat? Are you messy? Is there a time of day? Is there a certain bodily practice you like to do? I understand you're taking your studio practice outdoors. You're hugging trees.
Yeah.
What are sort of the conditions that you need or you create for your creativity?
Yeah, well, I'm actually quite neat. I like things orderly, except maybe if I'm like trying to make a body of work and I'm, you know, getting down to the wire and I need to get stuff done, then it gets a little messier. But I try to be orderly. Like my mind can focus when there's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
That's ADHD. I don't know what it is, but you know, so I'm like, yeah. So I need things like certain smells. Like in the morning when I wake up, there's a particular incense I like to burn.
Mm.
And there's something about that smell that gets me into the right headspace. I like routine. I have to have like my cup of tea every morning. It has to be done in this particular way. And then, you know, like I'll say my prayers and then I'll have breakfast and then I'll just read for a little while and then I'll spend time in my studio. You know, and when I come into my studio, it's like I'm kind of quiet for a little bit and I just look, I'll just sit and look at the work, kind of like say hello to everyone, because I do speak with them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly I'll just start, like if I have something right away, I'll start working on it right away. If not, I will just sit with the work until something else happens.
Mm-hmm. Is there a particular time of day you feel is more conducive for your practice?
Yeah, I mean, I will generally work from about, well, it kind of varies, but it's always from the afternoon into the evening.
Okay.
If I'm really stressed, I'm working till 2, 3, 4 in the morning. Yeah, generally, I would say from like 1 to 10, 1 to 9, with a break for dinner or something like that. Yeah.
How do you know when it's time to call it quits for the day?
When I get totally dysregulated or I'm just, yeah, because not every day I'm going to work 9 hours, right? Sometimes I'll work 5, sometimes I'll work 10. You know, it varies depending on like what's happening, because sometimes you get into the work and you can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then you keep seeing things you need to fix or you're excited about creating this piece. And yeah, so it can be a problem telling like when to stop. But when I start to feel really tired, I'll stop, but I'm trying to get better with that because for the first time in my life, I realized that I become very dysregulated and I never knew that before.
Mm.
This is the first time I realized, oh, wait, there's that feeling, that thing that I'm feeling. And like my head gets foggy and I'm like, okay, I need to stop and take some deep breaths and just kind of quit for the night.
Mm.
Yeah, but I didn't push myself sometimes a little too much and then I have to spend like half an hour trying to regulate my nervous system again.
Speaking of that and becoming conscious of your feelings, how do you take care of yourself? Like what acts of self-care do you engage in?
Well, I've gotten better. I used to do a lot of yoga. I don't do that as much anymore, but I do a lot of deep breathing. I spend a lot of time in my yard. I'm so fortunate to have a yard.
Are you gardening?
I have a swing in my yard. I spend a lot of time on the swing, but I walk a lot on the ground. Like grounding right now is super, super important. I was at a panel this past Saturday in California, and I met these lovely women, these Indian women from Africa, and like continued the conversation that was on the panel. And like they took me everywhere and showed me like parts of California where all the South Asians live and blah, blah, blah. And we hung out for like, I don't know, way too long. And I remember having to go back to my hotel, which thank God I had like an outside area. I remember just holding onto the trees, taking my shoes off and grounding my feet into the dirt and holding onto the tree and to the branches and just deep breathing. And that helped me like 10 minutes of that. Mm. And I felt.
I love that you speak to your work, you hug trees. I've been a little hiatus from my yoga practice, but at one point, yes, I love to be outside. I practice and achieve doing headstands in collaboration with trees. Now, I was looking at them as like sort of my collaborators. You talked about smells too. I've heard you say a few times, this multisensorial environment that on the one hand, when you go to Trinidad Tobago, there's certain smells that help you to feel grounded and help you feel at home. And I just think that's really fascinating, this multisensorial aspect of the body and the way that that gives a sense of homeness, as well as the rituals that you talked about, the routines that you get into. You mentioned earlier on that your mom was, you know, engaged in various rituals that really intrigued you. So I find it fascinating how we learn these things. Maybe we're not so conscious of them, but then they become part of our life, the way that we negotiate or enact our lives. So returning a little bit back to these ideas around your educational experiences, you pursued formal education, have a BFA from the University of Colorado and an MFA from the School of Art Institute in Chicago. I'm wondering about these formal educational experiences and your practice as an artist, these institutional learning environments. How have they impacted your work, as we've already been thinking about the way that spaces and places have been influencing to your work?
Well, with undergrad, I got more into photography. I don't know much. I don't know if the undergrad did much besides confuse me. And I went to, you know, grad school way later on in my life because I was out of the art world, so to speak, for a long time. I mean, I was always doing my work. I was always creating. But I never thought of it as a professional career. It was just something that I did, I loved. And then I started thinking, oh, maybe this could be a thing. And I'm thinking, okay, well, in order to fulfill this, I have to do this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. So I was like figuring into, okay, what are my next move? You know, if I wanted to be a lawyer, well, I would go to law school. So if I wanted to be an artist, maybe I should go to art school. You know, art school, I mean, it was a great experience for sure, right? I did a lot of traveling in art school as well, and met amazing artists. The conversations we had were so different in real life. You know, it's a whole other language, a whole way of existing. And it was kind of hard in the beginning. I almost didn't want to go back after the first semester. I was like, I don't get this. I don't understand this. I feel so far removed from the things that I know, from the things that make me feel confident, because I think they do that shit on purpose to kind of, you know, shake you up a little bit, you know, make you think differently, make you, I don't know, whatever they're trying to do, they were succeeding. And it wasn't until I had this visiting artist that I was part of the program where we would bring artists in and stuff like that. And I brought in this Egyptian artist. And I remember she came into my studio and she looked at my work and she said to me, you know, you're looking through the colonizer's eye. And I was like, okay, that changed everything for me. That one little sentence changed my entire work, changed everything, because I was struggling in much. I didn't really know what I was producing, but I just kept producing, you know, because I like to make work.
Yeah.
But I didn't know where and you're just going. And when she said that to me, it changed how I thought about it. It changed of what I wanted to photograph, how I wanted to photograph, and what I wanted to talk about. I wasn't thinking about my family history then, but I was thinking about home and how best to express that in the work. But grad school definitely helped me to kind of define like what I where and what I wanted this work to be and how to approach it. Yeah.
And that's interesting because I look at you as a researcher because research plays such a big part of your practice. You explore themes like indentureship and post-colonial narratives in Trinidad and Tobago. This requires deep research. And so I'm really grateful to hear this experience that you had in college looking through the colonizer's eyes. Wow. I mean,
I know.
Yeah, that's, I just completed my doctorate. I spent the last 5 years in classes, thinking, studying, relating, and all of that, you take it all in and then you graduate and it's like, what are you going to do with all of this? You have this new vision. You've thought about so many ways of looking and thinking about experience. And so, yeah, I mean, research plays such a big part because I almost feel like you finish with more questions. And
you do.
I love that your practice appears to me, at least, to be inquiry-based. You're constantly asking questions and engaging in research. So I'm curious about your research process, your research methods. Is it collaborative? Is it individual? What does your research practice look like?
It's both. Most of the time, it's by myself. It's interesting. One of my favorite ways to research is reading fiction. So the thing about reading like Caribbean writers or Indo-Caribbean writers or just Caribbean writers in general, when they start writing in your language, you know, it's you can taste the words.
Mm.
You look through their words. And I find I get more honest depictions of our lives through these fiction writers, you know, like say V.S. Naipaul, Samuel Selvin, you know, all the, I mean, they're amazing writers and they write about Trinidad, they write about home. And I can identify with so much of their words. But when I read a scholarly paper on indentureship, or it's like, I have to parse out, okay, I can see that, I understand that. I just feel a little more removed from things that I can't feel,
mm-hmm.
right? I also love speaking with a lot of older people who can maybe have some memory of their family on the plantations and working in the sugar factories and stuff like that. So I like oral projects as well. And that's actually going to broaden in this next iteration of my performance that I'm doing. So I'll be documenting stories and stuff more now.
You know, I love that.
Because I think it's important. I mean, there are people doing work on indentureship, you know, there are artists out there that are doing things. But for me, it just, this kind of community-based thing, just, I don't know, it was just a natural extension, you know, of the visual work. You know, it was like, okay, I've made this work. I've created these representations and these platforms for these women and these images to have, you know, to say something, right, through me, to say something through me.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was like, well, they're in a museum show, they're in a gallery show, and the people I'm talking about are not seeing this. They're not seeing this. They're not experiencing this.
Mm.
So I will collaborate with these different groups because I want them not only to see it, but I want them to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, experience that, like what I'm talking about, what their lives are about, they're part of that as well. It's both, it's individual and collaborative.
Wonderful. I love this. I'm looking forward to seeing the participatory nature of the project that you're working on. Looking at your work, I can see, and I love this idea of you incorporating reading fiction as part of your research methods, particularly because in your work, it transpires as you negotiate your personal experience alongside academic or archival research. There's a speculative nature that emerges that is what you produce. There's speculation in your work. There's a creative imaginary that is both grounded in your own social imaginary, but also deeply alongside archival research. And so that totally makes sense to me, this idea of fiction as part of, I love that. I'm super fascinated by that. I mean, I feel like I could have a whole conversation with you about that. I'm going to, but I'm going to leave that for the listeners to really do a deeper dive into that. And this, I love, you said, taste the words.
Yeah.
You talk a lot about the senses, tasting yeah. words, smelling, hugging, using your body, grounding. I was wondering, when you said you were going for these walks in the garden, are you doing that barefoot? It's a little bit random, but I'm yes. just curious.
No,
it's
always.
Important, right?
I'm always barefoot. I only put my shoes on if I have to go to a store.
I'm so glad I asked that, because I was imagining it barefoot. And I was like, because why would you create this layer, this barrier between yourself? If your purpose was to like make that connection, you almost like want to yeah. feeling the ground under your feet is a totally different situation.
Yeah. Oh my God. And also I love to go to Utah because of the rock formations are just so incredible. The colors are so incredible. And then you just take all your clothes off.
Oh, wow.
And you're just at these spaces, and in the summer, the rocks are like super hot. So when you hold them or hug them, they're really warm against
wow.
you. It's like you're having a conversation with them. The same thing with the trees. It's like a conversation that happens. It's like energetic conversation.
Do you have to like, are you finding like a secret space to do that? Or are there yeah. people around? What does that look like?
Now, there are a lot of places you could find. There are a lot of places you could find. It's like, I mean, it's huge and not everyone will go.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually, my husband and I will travel and he will know like these secret spots sometimes.
Mm.
So I'm going to be spending a lot of time in there in the next few weeks. I'm shooting some stuff out there as well. But yeah, it's such a beautiful feeling to just remove all your masks, you know, it, and just be as you were when you were created.
Mm.
And because the trees and in the ground, everything is as they are created.
Wow. Okay, right? Raluca, you're going to have me making a trip because I know I can't do that in New York City. But that definitely sounds very interesting. When you were saying that, it made me think about, I had gone through something very difficult and I felt like I needed to scream. And when that feeling emerged, I was like, where in the world would I go to scream the way I need to? Because if I yeah. do that, like, I don't want somebody calling the police and being like, somebody's like, something's going on. I realized I needed to be like in a certain situation, I needed a place for that. And then I ended up, my cousin called me and was like, oh, some friends and I are going to Jamaica and one canceled. Can you come mm-hmm. next week? And we ended up going on this bobsleds and I screamed so much. And at the end, wow. I was like, oh my gosh, thank you, God. Like, you heard me. And that was the type of screaming that I needed to do. I felt so much better. And my daughter recently made a little, she likes to play with cardboard, and she made a scream box.
Ooh, I love that.
I loved it too. I was like, oh my gosh, this is brilliant. She like, yeah. she made this box that you can like scream into. And we both practiced screaming into it. And a couple of days ago, I was like, oh my gosh, I need the scream box.
That's a great idea. Oh my God. Yeah, I love that. And that, what made her do that?
I'm not sure. I'm curious, like, what was going on that particular day. But she'll tell you, I'm an artist. She's 6 years old.
I love it.
And she already knows she's an artist. I've been taking her to museums and artist spaces since she could walk. And yeah, right. So she's always trying to create. She's trying to save everything and tells me she wants to use it to make art. And sometimes I'm like, aww, wait a minute, we have, so we have all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, we have to make edit. We have to take some things in and take some things out. But yeah. I just love this idea of like, I mean, it might sound funny for some, but like this idea of your bare body engaging with the land. I almost feel like that's something that I'm so curious about how that would be to experience. So thank you for planting that seed. The day that I do that, I'll let you know how that went.
Let me know. I'll go with you.
Yes.
Actually, it's like I did a shoot in Santa Fe in this area that was just covered with cacti or cactuses. Anyway, uh-huh. And like about a month ago, and I still have like some embedded in my foot. So sometimes when I walk, I'll hit like maybe something and it'll give me like a slight pain on my foot. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. There's cactus needle in my foot.
So there's like a level of risk and danger and courage It, definitely a level of courage.
There is. I never realized.
Yeah, I mean, some people would, this would be really challenging for just the idea of being nude in nature. It would require immense, so that amounts of courage. So you emphasize the role of women as both storytellers and protectors of the land.
Mm-hmm.
What aspects of their identities do you aim to amplify in your practice?
Talk about imaginaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think I focus on how strong and loving and resilient they were and continue to be. When I think about my grandmother who came over, you know, when growing up, we thought that my grandmother, my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, came together on the ship, that they were together, that they were married.
Mm-hmm.
When I found the copy of the immigration passes, I realized they came from different parts of Uttar Pradesh, right? And knowing that my grandmother, a single person, very young woman, finding her way to Calcutta because the boats left from Calcutta, and imagining, well, how did she get from all the way up north, the travel, thousands of miles probably, to the west? And I'm thinking, well, what does she have to endure? What did that mean for a young single woman to find her way to the port? You know, and I know that there were a lot of people recruiting. Women were actually particularly difficult to recruit because they weren't allowed to leave. So they used to also recruit widows, you know, to sort of like, hey, you don't need to live like this. And so many people were poor. Like, I know my family were farmers. And so it was, you know, the British were already messing them up there. The land wasn't being productive. They were under high taxes, whatever the situation was. So, you know, some people will say, well, that's a choice. And I say, well, that's not a choice. That's just a way of surviving, to leave and think to yourself, okay, I can make a better life elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those are the kind of strengths that I want to engage with and talk about when I talk about these women, and especially the women in the postcards that I work with, because these women were taken, you know, from wherever they were working, brought into the capital city, put into a studio to be photographed. And now, when I first learned about these women, which were, they called them coolie belles, it was this French photographer, and he wasn't the only one. There were photographers doing this in all of the other islands, right? And I started thinking, well, how did these women get there? Did they agree to this? Were they compensated? Did the photographer care that maybe after he took their photos, maybe they were, who knows what a partner might have done?
Mm-hmm.
Part of me would like to think that, yes, they decided that they were going to, that they were going to do this, that they wanted to be photographed. But another part of me is saying, no,
mm-hmm.
like, I don't think that being a thing, because these postcards were then used to sell
to
Western tourists, right? To entice them to come. And so it's like, so I hope all these questions as to why they were dressed alike, they all looked alike, they all these similar, but the positions of their body, and 95% of them didn't smile.
Mm.
You know, so if they were happy to be there, I feel like maybe they would have smiled. But trauma is a funny thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trauma and how we, it's like, it's how we process that and how our bodies can betray us as well. Right? So I wanted to just, I want to protect them, and I treat them with the utmost respect, like goddesses. I treat them like that. And so for me, it's their strength, it's their perseverance, the will, this will to survive, and where all of that comes from, and to understand them as modern women as well. Because I, you know, I'm going through this process of unmasking, hence why I'm using the word so much. But I'm going through that process, and I realize that, like, we are all on the same journey. The women that I'm working with in my art, we are all on the same journey. We are traveling. And we're walking parallel to each other.
Right.
And so it's like, I think that's, I really want to talk about that and what it's like to walk together with them, to sort of like hold hands and to have these conversations and to understand each other on a more, like, a deeper level, and to connect on this deeper level. And I'm using nature in that way to communicate to them or with them.
When you're talking just now, the way that you were analyzing the photographs, it definitely made me think about Tina Kamp's text, Listening to Images. She talks about attuning to the barely detectable frequencies, the low frequencies that are like, that don't almost register in images. And so she looks at, she does a similar process to what you've done with these images, this series of questions that you're asking about the conditions of those photos that were taken. In this case, she was looking at images of immigrants to England from, I believe, South Africa, who were taking passport pictures. And she was wondering about all these different conditions of the sitting, similar to what you've done. So yeah, Tina Kamp, Listening to Images. So you're a multidisciplinary artist. You work with photography, installation, performance, archival materials. Do you find certain mediums better suited for specific aspects of your storytelling and exploration and research? How do you choose which medium you're going to engage in?
Yes. I mean, I feel like different pieces speak to me differently. You know, sometimes there's, you know, language kind of gets in the way, right? Because you're asking me something that I feel, that I experience as a feeling more so than a word, you know? But I mean, the community projects, they're performance pieces. Like, that's an easy one. Okay. They're performance pieces, but they're also photographic and stuff like that. As far as like the mixed media work, I think a lot of it, like I said earlier on, comes from my experience as a kid growing up in Trinidad and having all those amazing, lovely memories, you know, my surroundings and the people involved. And my, like, I think about like my aunts, like my mom's sisters, and how much I love them and how they are really strong, funny women. Or my uncles, like one particular uncle who's had long hair in his ear that I used to play with. You know, like, oh, you know, like all these little things, all that feeds into, you know, like, how can I translate those things now into material? You know, and that's just really how it happens. And if I don't have it, the material at my studio, I'll go find it somewhere. I like to travel to New York a lot because I go into the Little Guyana in the Queens. I have little items that I like to buy because they have stuff like from my country. But I can also find stuff on Amazon. Like, there's a chocolate I used to eat, you know, that I love to actually find on Amazon. But yeah, so it's like I think about items from my childhood and I try to recreate that in a different way. Or if I can get my hands on the actual item, then I will, it will become part of the work.
I've learned so much about the histories that you're engaging with from you, from your practice. This is one of the reasons why I love art, because I look at artists as teachers and the works that you make as pedagogical, as the work teaches as well. And you've given talks and master classes and you speak at on panels and institutions. And I'm wondering, do you see yourself as an educator in any sense? How does sharing your knowledge with others, whether through teaching or public speaking, feed back into your own understanding and development as an artist?
I feel any population of people that have been colonized in some way or dominated in some way or torn apart in some way, I think there's so many people that are curious about their past. You know, when I started doing this project, so many people in the Indo-Caribbean community wanted to know, how did I get that information? Where did I get, how did I find my grandparents' immigration passes? I think there's this need to belong. People need this. And I think it's not just about identity. It's about feeling safe, about feeling welcomed, about feeling seen, that we exist and we're part of this world. And so, you know, when I first started working with these images in 2020, you know, they were bold and confrontational, and the women would look at you and, you know, you can look into their faces and they were almost like confronting you and questioning you as to why. And now, you know, I'm like sort of abstracting them even more now, allowing less access and putting them in these more natural contemplative spaces to give them that sense of safety, that sense of dignity, that sense of, like, you know, a long time, so to speak, because we all need that. And we all need communities, because this whole individualism crap that the West feeds us is just a way to weaken us. Mm-hmm.
It's a way to keep it separate and not ask any questions. You know, it's a way to keep us stupid and unhappy. And the only way to really build any strength is through collaborations and through community. And so when I'm teaching, I feel that that's what I'm doing. I'm bringing a source of strength to a community by giving them more information about things they'd never had before, you know, and just to bond, no matter who the community is. It's just a way of bonding because so many people could identify with the women in my images, with what they've been through, what they, you know, and that past and that history. Yeah. So I love it. I don't know if I see myself as an educator, but I love doing it and I love working with young people. And I, you know, I think gotta get them when they're young. You gotta you gotta let them know. So I had this other project where I'm doing something for like the younger folks, the little kids now. And I'm not going to speak about that because it's sort of like, and it's just a national issue. So yeah.
Wonderful. I think that's so profound what you've touched on. And it circles back to what we started with, this importance of connections and proximity to cultivating a sense of belonging, but not only belonging, you've expanded that to a sense of safety. This idea that feeling safe is connected to proximity, to belonging. And normally people might think about physical safety, but I imagine you're also thinking about psychological safety, emotional safety.
Yes.
So that's really, really profound. And I am really grateful for that response. So my last question for you is, do you have any advice? What advice would you offer to emerging women artists, particularly those exploring their own cultural histories and identities through their practice?
I would say stay true to yourself. Be authentic. Don't copy anyone. Because what's important is to see your art through your eyes and your personal experiences and your own interpretations rather than through someone else's. And I think staying true to yourself is most important, and to not be afraid of digging deep and finding things out as hard as they are, because you're always going to come out better on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think, you know, don't think about the art world at large. Don't think about money. Don't think about selling. Don't think about having to earn a living, because that is secondary. And I know that's like a privilege to say, but it's the truth. You know, everybody likes to sell more, sure. But that can't be the reason you make work. Like, you have to really look at yourself. There's a lot of self. There's a lot of introspection that happens as an artist. And you can't be afraid of that. That's the only way you're going to make your best work.
Courage to create. Yes.
Courage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Renluka Maharaj, thank you so much for your time today, for spending this hour with me in dialogue and community. And I'm just so grateful for your work, for your practice, and for what I've learned from you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for joining this insightful conversation with Renluka Maharaj. Her reflections on ancestry, identity, and the rituals of creation are a powerful reminder of the grounding force of heritage. I hope you've been as inspired as I am by her journey and the resilience she brings to her work. Stay tuned for more thoughtful discussions with global women artists on Beyond Beauty, where we continue to explore stories and creative visions shaping our world today from women artists around the world.